10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This is Dr. Tommy Anelli, and this is the Croc Podcast. Good afternoon, Crockers. This is your friend, Dr. Tommy Anelli, and I am here on another Wednesday afternoon, a sunny Wednesday afternoon in the Hudson Valley with a blue sky and cotton candy clouds. Next to me on the left, Professor Angel Santana, the greatest podcaster slash producer slash pal in the universe. Hey, Angel, how are you?
I got to tell you, I wish people could see what I'm seeing right now. What a view.
Yes.
You have.
Yes.
The sun is shining, the clouds, it's beautiful.
It is a beautiful day. And I actually want to start today's podcast with a question. Usually it's a story, and you know it'll evolve into a story, but let's start with a simple question. Have you ever had a project, a very, very challenging project that you probably suffered like crazy when you were going through that project, but at the end of the project, you kind of missed it. You missed the challenge. You missed the opportunity. You missed just getting yourself up to be your best.
I had to think about that for a second.
Yeah, you sure did.
Yeah.
You might have to edit that dead space there.
No. That's, you know what? If I thought about it.
Yes.
That means they're thinking about it.
Yes.
So, yeah, I have to say, I yeah.
You know, I don't know if you feel the same way, but I kind of feel that now that we're ending the first module, we're ending the defining survivorship module. And I have to tell you what I'm going to miss about it. It was sort of an evolution in our podcast. Now, everyone knows out there who are listening to us knows that we're a very young podcast where this is maybe episode 6 or so. And we'll never have those first 6 episodes again. This was a new thing for us. It was exciting. The first time I read off of a piece of paper, and then I sort of started ad-libbing. I started developing what would you call a podcasting style, and you helped coach me. And now I feel like a podcasting veteran, and I'm going to miss that. It's like you just showed me a picture of Ariel, mm-hmm. who's looking like a young lady, and you're going to miss her as a baby. And then in a couple of years, you're going to miss her at this age. And I kind of feel the same way about this podcast. In addition, when we first started the Croc Podcast, I had no idea where we were going with it. So our first episode, we met Beth Denninger from her husband, Al. We talked about the waiting room, kind of introduced everyone to the Croc Podcast, the Croc Nation, the Croc, I guess, mission, what we were trying to do about our history. So you guys didn't think we were a bunch of, you know, scary people that were hiding in shadows. We actually have a history. So, you know, gave us a little validity. And then when I started walking into this defining survivorship with the concept that we were going to start from fresh, it's a new podcast, we're going to build the foundation and build it strong. And we started with the definitions. I really thought I knew a lot more than I did about survivorship. Here I was, you know, basically dabbling in survivorship for 23, 25 years before anybody was dabbling, except for the guest who we're going to have today, who I'm really excited about, by the way. And at the end of the day, it sort of dawned on me that we are a educational resource for our Croc Nation, for our survivors. And the concept of putting all of these different subjects into a educational module, almost like a college course, you know, just made all the sense in the world to me. And I am so excited about that idea, about the module. And then we dove deep into defining survivorship. We started with Dr. Mullen. As a matter of fact, it was so deep we dove that the first episode actually took 2 episodes. We met Greer Cooper, one of our amazing survivors, interviewed her. Then we went into the transition of survivorship from the early days of Dr. Mullen to sort of what happened thereafter for the next decade or two. And then we sort of took a little detour, looked at a different point of view. We had our dear friend, Dr. Deming, Katie Deming out in Portland, Dr. Len Berry in Texas, talking to us about how some survivors don't want to be labeled as a survivor, but something to their choosing. Then we went and we met Allison Whelan, who was a great nurse practitioner who specializes in survivorship planning and survivorship plans. We enjoyed that. And we started our next module, which is our surveillance module, which we'll also continue with. But how do we end something so spectacular as our first podcast module?
Honestly, I looked at it this way. As your producer, it's just to kind of reiterate what you said, you were groundbreaking, and you have evolved over time in the last few episodes, but we have been waiting for this special guest.
Oh, my God. Well, let me tell you this about this special guest.
Yeah, the buildup.
So, Dr. Charles Shapiro is a professor of medicine at Mount Sinai, specializes in breast cancer. But when I was thinking about how to introduce him, and I just want you guys to know that we're doing this introduction on a Wednesday. We're actually going to tape him on a Friday. He doesn't know what we're saying right now. The next time he's going to hear what we have to say about him, it's going to be too late because we will have already published this podcast and he may want to kill us, but that's okay. When I was thinking about what to say about Dr. Charles Shapiro, all Croc Nation knows I'm a sports fan. I even have a sports locker now in my office, which holds some of my jerseys that I'll be wearing this week. Knows that I love sports, and I particularly love baseball. Angel and I are big Mets fans. And I was thinking about the Hall of Fame because, Dr. Deming is a Hall of Famer. Dr. Berry is a Hall of Famer. And I was thinking about an analogy, right? We talk about stories and analogies. All players who earn the privilege to get into the Hall of Fame has to know how to play the game at the highest level. Right. So I went to the website. I looked up at the Hall of Fame and I got a couple of players that I really liked or maybe grew up watching, like Gary Carter was my favorite catcher, although he went in as an expo. Gary, it's OK. He is also a great man who passed away sadly of brain cancer. Al Kaline, who recently died from the Tigers, played in the outfield for the Tigers. Remember Juan Marichal with that big kick? He used to pitch for the Giants. And that leg used to go up over his head. Harmon Killebrew, number three, the big first baseman for the Twins. I loved him because that was my lucky number, was number three, and he was number three. Catfish Hunter, I have his jersey, pitched for the A's, pitched for the Yankees. And I thought, wow, these are players of the highest level, right? These are Hall of Fame players. But there are a few players that are Hall of Famers, but they're different. They didn't just play the game at the highest level. They changed the game. They are the few that really breathe rarefied air. These are the Hall of Famers who sit on Mount Olympus and they look down upon all the mortals. And I'm going to give you examples. So obviously Babe Ruth comes to mind. The first real personality, baseball superstar, home run hitter, Joe DiMaggio, whose 56 game hitting streak may never be equaled or surpassed. Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. I mean, what's up with that? I mean, not letting African-American players play baseball or any sport, professional sport, because of the color of their skin. And then you had this guy who breaks into the majors, can't even stay at the same hotels as his teammates, probably the best athlete in the league, and got treated like dirt and couldn't even say anything about it, had to just take it and be a great player. And he brought a championship to Brooklyn. Lou Gehrig, who played with Lou Gehrig's disease. I mean, imagine him, the Iron Horse, playing to the level with the neuromuscular condition. And of course, there's Hank Aaron. Hammer and Hank Aaron, who broke Babe Ruth's record. And while he was trying to achieve that record, he got more death threats than probably anybody in the history of the earth. When he hit a home run, he didn't know whether someone was going to be taking a shot at him or trying to kill him or assassinate him. Imagine every time you hit a home run and you're chasing, the great Bambino. And just because of the color of your skin, you get, this hatred. And of course, there was Bob Gibson, Bob Gibson was as mean a man who ever lived. He was so mean and he was so good that they actually lowered the pitching mound because of Bob Gibson. So these were Hall of Famers that just surpassed all of the other Hall of Famers because they not only played the game great, they also changed the game. And Dr. Charles Shapiro is that type of Hall of Famer. He is a Hall of Famer at that level. He is a very special doctor who really has changed the world. He and I are separated by 2 years, but our careers are completely different. He is a doctor's doctor. He is the type of doctor that has really changed the practice of oncology. And particularly, why did we invite him to this podcast? He really changed the game when it comes to survivorship. So let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Charles Shapiro. His curriculum vitae is 27 pages. Mine is 2. The only thing in common we have, and I hope he likes baseball, but the only thing in common we have is we both went to state school. So he went to college in Binghamton, and he went to college. He went to medical school in Buffalo. He was elected to the AOA, which is the Alpha Omega Alpha, which is the top medical students in the world. I know you're thinking, Angel, am I an AOA guy? I am not an AOA guy. I'm not even an AWOA. I'm just a regular guy. I want to also make mention of a couple of things. I have a couple of words to describe him, but I do want to go through his CV quickly because I could spend 10 podcasts. We could do a module on Dr. Shapiro's CV, right? So to become a professor of medicine, it's like becoming a 5-star general. And I'm sure we're not going to talk about this on the podcast, but I'm sure he could tell you some funny stories about academic medicine and all the politics and things like that. But to go up from the ranks of an adjunct to an assistant, to an associate, to a full associate, then to a full professor of medicine is not an easy task. You cannot be a regular guy or regular person, guy or gal, to achieve that. He is currently the director of translational breast cancer at Mount Sinai. I'll explain that. Director of cancer survivorship as well. As I said, professor of medicine. He comes to us from New York State, and then he went off to Harvard. He did via Philadelphia. He did his internal medicine training at Temple and then went over to Harvard and did his medical oncology and hematology and stayed there as an assistant professor. Went on to become, really make his bones, I guess you would say, over at Ohio State until then he came over to Mount Sinai, who was very lucky to have him. And we're very lucky to have him locally as well in the Northeast. He is basically, his honors and awards are too numerous to mention, but I did want to mention elected to the Who's Who in the World, Forbes magazine, top breast cancer oncologist, recognized for being in the top percent of patient satisfaction. So not only is he good at what he does, he loves his patients and apparently his patients love him, which is huge and important. You know that. He is on editorial boards. He is a grant reviewer for the NIH. He is on the board for the Journal of Cancer Survivorship. He has basically been a top investigator, if not the top investigator, for a huge cooperative group called the Cancer and Leukemia Group B, which study about 7 different cancers, including breast. And I want to just talk to you guys a little bit about a couple of words I have for him. And then, of course, his publications are just too numerous to mention in this podcast and his book chapters and his presentations and all that kind of thing. But what I did want to say is when I think of Charles Shapiro, and I've never met him, and I have yet to speak to him personally, and I'm so looking forward to that. But I think of the words impactful, but not impactful just in a regional way or in a national way, but like and not even in an international way, but in a global way. A diplomat, because in order to achieve what he has, he has to be able to get all sides on the table. And believe me, you get 5 doctors to go to dinner, you know, you're not going to agree to the restaurant for about 3 weeks. So imagine him trying to put together these clinical trials that are going to be done in multiple institutions. And you can imagine the fireworks behind closed doors. An innovator, and we're going to find out a little bit more of his innovation with cancer survivorship. Translational medicine is taking the science of medicine at the most basic level. So we call it in the business the basic sciences. So the biologies, the biochemistries, the physiologies, the anatomies, the pharmacologies, but that's all science on a very bench, on a benchmark type of, meaning it's done on a bench with rats and dogs and all sorts of things. No offense to animal people. Let's forget about the animal analogy, but on cells, you know, cell cultures and things like that. And then taking this research, taking the findings from this research and be able to provide it to the bedside. So from bench side to bedside, that's kind of what his thing is, what he's known for, to be able to take an innovation that he innovated and be able to bring it to his patients in the clinic. And we'll explain a couple of those as well. I think of generous because here's a guy as important as they get, willing to give up, you know, an hour of his time to talk to this completely untested and brand new raw, I always use the word raw, podcast. Humble, because if he wasn't humble, he wouldn't be talking to me or you, Angel. I kind of think of him as like the Tony Stark, like the Iron Man, like the guy who's the genius, but still able to, you know, and wants to change the world, but has a humor about it and has his own sort of style about it. So I kind of, even though I've never met Dr. Shapiro, I'm going to see like Robert Downey Jr., like in a Iron Man suit. That's kind of what I'm going to be thinking. And I wanted to just kind of end this introduction by looking at his research profile. So in his own words, he states that the first significant contribution. Now with me, I don't even know if I have a significant contribution. He starts his resume, my first significant contribution. So imagine having multiple significant contributions. But check this out, and this is really important, and the reason why I love Dr. Shapiro and why we wanted him on this podcast for you survivors during this module for defining survivorship is because we always talked about curing the patient is important, but quality of life is important as well. Identifying the special unique needs of a cancer survivor, the long-term side effects, all the things that really impact the person's life, really the life juice, that life, like what is your essence of life, is affected also by these treatments. And his primary, as he said, significant contribution was to recognize that premenopausal women, so women who have not gone through menopause with breast cancer, who've gone through chemotherapy, get sort of sucked into this early ovarian failure, this early menopause, and they lose bone rapidly and their life becomes terrible, even though they may be cured of their cancer. And he was the guy who figured this out, saw this need, went after this need and did countless, you know, papers and research to try to put medications in place to try to combat that phenomenon that occurs. The second significant contribution he mentioned by using microRNA biomarkers, I can't tell you I know what that is, but certainly important in order to find out how the breast cancer survivor is doing, to have a test to be able to assay that. And then on the national level, and this is why, again, he's being asked to join us today. He served as the chair of symptom intervention for the CLGB. So symptom intervention, think about that for the cancer survivor. Curing you is not enough. We need to cure you and give you a good quality of life. And that's kind of what his entire career has been. He served as the chair of the ASCO, American Society of Clinical Oncology Survivorship Committee, focusing on education. Remember, I first mentioned what I called the 10 Commandments of Survivorship that came up with Dr. Mullen and his different pursuits. Well, you know, I would not be shocked if Dr. Shapiro didn't know Dr. Mullen personally or sit arm in arm with him and you know, develop these things. he created what now we're going to call on this podcast the core curriculum of cancer survivorship. And what we're going to be focusing on this podcast after we take a brief break is focusing on the paper. It was a review article from the New England Journal of Medicine that was published in 2018, really beautifully and concisely discussing the needs of the cancer survivor. We will try to get that reference to you on our website. It's just a pleasure and an honor. I can't even tell you, it's not even a pleasure or an honor. It's an absolute coup that we were able to get him on this podcast. And I just want to say that Angel and I are devoted to giving you guys the highest quality podcast to give you the greatest amount of information and impact for your survivorship needs. And I have to tell you that I thought we've done it every single time, but today we hit a grand slam home run from, as I said, that Hall of Famer. So hold on to your seats, fasten your seat belts. It's going to get pretty rough and we're going to hit some turbulence and talk about some great stuff. I will see you on the other side of our announcements.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back, my Croc Nation friends. As promised, Dr. Charles Shapiro, Professor of Medicine, Mount Sinai. Dr. Shapiro, I want to first thank you, and I want to clarify this thank you. Of course, Angela and I are thankful for you coming on this podcast. It's a brand new podcast. We're still kind of figuring it out. And to have someone of your caliber who has done so much for our survivors to accept this invitation is certainly worthy of a sincere and genuine thank you. But I, as an oncologist myself, as a physician, as someone who really cares a lot about cancer patients, I wanted to thank you on a much deeper level. I wanted to thank you for you. I wanted to thank you for your career. I wanted to thank you for your work. I wanted to thank you for everything you've done, all of your innovations, which we went into in some detail in your introduction. But I wanted to thank you for your career. Thank you. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
Yeah, so you're welcome. And I'm thrilled to be here. I'm humbled that you asked me.
So as I told you offline, we were kind of going through the history of survivorship. We went through Dr. Mullen's contribution. He was already a great man who's vision to help with health disparities in his career was enough. And then he got struck with cancer. We almost killed him, right? His oncologist almost killed him. And then he went on to survive, have children and have a great career. And I'm sure you guys rub shoulders trying to look at that arid landscape, which we now call survivorship. It wasn't even called anything in those days. And I just had mentioned to you, you found yourself in Boston at Harvard doing your fellowship maybe 2 years after the publication of this paper. And I kind of wanted to get your view now. We're looking 35 years later at, you know, what the landscape was, even at, you know, the best hospital in the world, you know, the Dana-Farber, where, you know, Stanley Farber did all that amazing, you know, innovative work, and you're there in those hallways, and his ghost was probably, he wasn't even dead yet, you know, kind of walking the halls and kind of talking about survivorship and the special, milieu, which sort of had used people involved, not just in the cure of cancer, but in advocating for the survivor and the special needs of the survivor. You know, give us your view from those days.
Well, those days are not dissimilar to what you found yourself, a desert, basically. No one was thinking about survivorship. Everything was focused on new drugs, like paclitaxel was new in the day, and adriamycin was new in the day. We were all focused on curing the patient, but the after effects of treatment, particularly of survivors, was not in our radar screen. It's not on the radar screen. I did a quick and dirty back of the envelope calculation. And when Nixon declared war on cancer in 1973, there were two papers published with the title Survivorship. And it's been exponentially growing since then, but it was a bleak desert and nobody was thinking about it.
When you were, you know, in Boston and then off to, I think you went to Ohio State after that. You were then sort of seeing a change. You were probably at those national level meetings, you know, where the core curriculum from the American Academy of Medicine came up with those 10 tenets or whatever. Give us your view from those days.
Yeah, so those were quite a bit later, like 20 years later, they came out. And that was the first organized effort, I think, to really put survivors in focus as an unmet need group. And that was very useful. But I'll tell you the truth, even today, survivorship is not integrated into the mainstream of cancer care. So I say that with a heavy heart. I wish it was, but we've made incredible progress in treating its survivors and knowing about the difficulties they encounter, both financially and due to treatment, but it's not integrated into the mainstream of cancer care as yet.
That is very disheartening, actually, and I do agree with you. I think one of the frustrations I have, you know, you from the medical oncology side and me from the radiation side, we see tumors shrink, we see them evaporate, and then we see these patients and we're very giddy, we're showing them their x-rays and we're patting ourselves on the back, and yet we're seeing a shell of a person, we're seeing a ton of harm. And I'm looking at your paper and it was just one of the, I mean, the paper was great and we're going to try to get it on the website for people to review. But I wanted to say that just looking at some of these things that we do to patients as a cost, as a residue of cure, we talk about chronic pain. You talk about infertility, gonadal failure, neuropathies. You talk about fatigue, things we don't even think about, right? Insomnia, not being able to sleep, sexual dysfunction, metabolic syndrome, bone loss. And that was obviously, that's what made, you know, made your insight into that. And we'll get into that in a second as an example. Cognitive dysfunction, cardiac damage, heart failure, valvular damage, dysfunction of the heart, fractures, again, your specialty, uterine cancers, secondary cancers, leukemias, all those types of things. And I have to say, from my point of view, and I'm going to let you comment, let you take the ball up. Here we sit and we're seeing these great cures, but we're seeing people devastated from what we do to them. So on the radiation side, of course, from the chemotherapy side, of course, I was wondering if you could address you know, those, that table that was in your paper.
Yeah. So, in addition to the things you mentioned, I think that, chemotherapy, we're learning more and more of premature aging during chemotherapy, and chemotherapy causes a lot of things that are associated with aging. For example, telomere shortening, is one thing. Cytokines that are associated with aging, proteins that are associated with aging. So chemotherapy causes premature aging. And one thing we both glossed over, I put it in the line in the paper, but financial toxicity. Many people can't afford cancer care and they're banking, they're losing their mortgages in their homes and back to work issues. You'd be surprised about the number of cancer patients that don't go back to work because of these problems. So financial toxicity is equally important to the personal problems these survivors encounter.
Absolutely. And I think you're reading my notes because I have all that, the telomere damage, and I was going to ask you about that. But using actually your innovative work with premenopausal women with breast cancer, talking about your insight as far as their bone loss, their diminished quality of life. Let's kind of use that as a model of an example of one of the special circumstances that are cancer survivors. So this woman with breast cancer, she's 46 years old. I'm sorry, we'll even go 36 years old, has a growing family. They get chemotherapy. They go into premature menopause. They start losing bone, and they're just basically their lifestyle is totally destroyed at this point. And you have this insight, this as I said, bench side to bedside, translational experience. And it really was groundbreaking, by the way. And when I thank you, I thank you for that as well as many other things. But that was especially important in our work. So let's use that as an example, a premenopausal woman getting chemotherapy, a perfect example of the special needs of our survivors.
Yeah, so there's two issues here. One is, very frequently, women who get adjuvant chemotherapy go into chemotherapy-induced ovarian failure. And that's associated with a lot of bone loss. And estrogens are protective against bone loss. And if you diminish estrogens, you make them in effect postmenopausal, then they lose bone, and they lose bone earlier than they would have had they not had breast cancer and not going through natural menopause. So it's a big problem. It's treatable. Awareness is the key. Awareness is the key, because getting DEXA scans, bone density scans, and knowing what to pull the trigger in based on those scans, about pull the trigger in terms of anti-resorptive agents, is the key. So osteoporosis is a preventable problem as long as you're aware that chemotherapy-induced ovarian failure leads to osteoporosis and leads to fractures. And one other thing, fertility is a big issue. And we've learned that fertility is an important concern, particularly in a young person, 35, she may want to have more children. So there's certain things you can do to preserve menstrual function, like adding a GnRH agonist like Zoladex to the chemotherapy that tends to preserve menstrual function. And in vitro fertilization would be another aspect of care in that group.
So in your clinic, in your breast cancer clinic, with this known, and again, it's not known everywhere, do you have access to these, these resources for your breast cancer patients?
Yeah, I happen to work in a major academic medical center, and I have all the resources. I'm not sure that everybody has the same resources distributed around the country. And that's an imbalance I'm always interested in interventions that are exportable to the community, because that's the, that's the common denominator. That's the area where the most patients are treated, not in the cancer centers, which are least often resource intensive, but in the community where most of the cancer care is delivered. So any interventions, I'm always thinking about, can we export them to the community, not just the cancer center?
Gotcha. And, that brings up two really important points. When you say not accessible, accessible to community centers, I'm in a community center that's only about maybe 90 minutes away from where your office sits. And that's with traffic. So we're very close to each other, yet we're worlds apart. Getting patients over in Orange County, Sullivan County, Dutchess County, we have anybody from the New York City policemen and firemen families up here to dairy farmers, who eighth generation dairy farmers. you know, to just your good old blue collar worker kind of thing, trying to convince them to go into the city to see Dr. Shapiro and his crew is not always the easiest thing, not just financially, but also just logistically. So there are challenges we still have.
Yes, indeed.
So when we look at this scenario, again, each cancer patient is unique. You would agree with that. And you would say that each cancer patient who has finished treatment has challenges that are unique to their survivorship journey. You mentioned one that's extraordinarily curable, one that's treatable, is this bone loss from women premenopausal women that are then rendered in ovarian failure. One of the things that I have found so difficult, and I wrote in my notes here, we almost feel like we are, we have the impotence of caretakers, meaning that we try to repair the unrepairable. So we do this damage to people, and there are sometimes no really great fixes. So if there's a patient who I always look at my prostate guys, and they've had their prostatectomies or not to, you know, radiation oncologists always, you know, poke fun at the urologist. But of course, with radiation therapy, there's impotence and erectile dysfunction. And there's all sorts of things. We know our young people that we treated for Hodgkin's disease in the early days of our careers that now have coronary artery disease or they have secondary cancers. You know, it's very frustrating because even we as specialists sometimes scratch our heads and don't really know what to do with these people, peripheral neuropathies with long-term dysphagia, dry xerostomia. These are all fancy words, everybody, for dry mouth and difficulty swallowing and taste of food. And of course, you know, erectile dysfunction and things like that. But would you mind just commenting on that frustration from when you go into the clinic?
Yeah, so I'm frustrated too, but I think that there's a movement in oncology to de-escalate therapies. And Hodgkin's disease is a perfect example of de-escalating therapies so that now there isn't so much coronary artery disease. That's in the old days when we used fields that were
The big mantle fields, those massive, yes, exactly.
So there's a big move to de-escalate therapy, and de-escalating therapy, the pentadental example of that is no therapy, which genomic assays in breast cancer have led us to believe and proven that 75% of the patients can be spared chemotherapy. And only 25% need it. So it's mechanisms like that, genomic testing for de-escalating therapy, Hodgkin's disease for de-escalating therapies, and other cancers for de-escalating therapies. That's a recognition or the flip side of these survivorship issues that are so difficult for people.
Yeah, and you also hit on just another important aspect of your interest and in your contribution to the microRNA assays that you've been working on. Again, I promised the listeners that I would have you explain to them what translational medicine is, and you are the chairman of translational breast cancer at Mount Sinai. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you're working on.
Well, translation is nothing more than a two-way street, bench to bedside and bedside to bench. Scientists often know nothing or next to nothing about the clinic, and we as clinicians know everything about the patients, but I have no idea about the science. So we have to work together, and translational research is a two-way street. Bench to bedside, but bedside to bench in terms of observations made in the clinic that get explained in the lab. So that's what I'm pushing in my center, observations that are translated from the bench to bedside and bedside to bench.
And again, as I said to the listeners prior to our part of the podcast, that's what makes you so special, is because you actually are able to bridge that. You are a clinician first and foremost, but also have a great deal of experience and interest in basic research, basic science. I'm sure you even go and teach medical students on occasion, I'm sure, some of these things. And that is a very special position, because we as physicians, we sometimes make fun of the, you know, the scientist nerds and things and that are working on, you know, cell cultures or whatever, but it takes a very special clinician. Clinicians respect clinicians, but we especially respect clinicians who also are investigators and scientists and who do this research, who come up with these innovative ideas. So I, again, this is my 18th thank you to you, Dr. Shapiro. But again, I am going to now go into a little bit of a different direction, talking a little bit about some of the other aspects of your paper I wanted you to comment on. You then go into talk about, we talked about the unique circumstances of the survivor and what their journey will be and what they have to deal with. You also give a great deal of emphasis on things that other people don't: health promotion, psychological well-being, caring for our special populations, and especially recognizing and bringing into the mix, into the survivorship mix, the caregivers. So I wanted you maybe to comment on that aspect of your paper.
Caregivers are the unsung heroes of cancer care. I mean, a lot of problems caregivers have are the same problems that survivors have: anxiety, depression, back to work issues, the same things that caregivers, cancer patients have as a consequence of therapy and having cancer. The caregiver by proxy is involved in the same issues. So we have to recognize and make programs for caregivers. And there's starting to be a trickling of those caregiver programs and recognition that there's two entities we have to treat: the cancer patient and the caregiver. Special populations, including the geriatric population. I have a curve in my paper that 65 and older are the number one group for now in the future that get cancer. So it's really geriatric oncology is a good thing to be in right now, because it's going to be a career that sustains you for the next 40 years. So special populations, pediatric, who comes an adult, it gets treated for cancer and becomes an adult, and they fall in the crap. So there's a lot of special populations that are needing our attention in this survivorship realm.
Very well said. And I also wanted to say that when you were working with ASCO and putting this quote-unquote core curriculum together from those 10 tenets that we've discussed, you mentioned care coordination and communication, meaning trying to get the primary care physician, trying to get the oncologist, trying to put everybody on the same page, treatment summaries, individualized care plans, identify gaps in research. I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that. I guess you call it the shared care model.
Yeah, so the shared care model is nothing more than what it says: sharing the care with another physician. And truly, primary care physicians can do it, can do survivorship care. They just have to be educated about what it is and what they have to do. So it's a model that integrates the oncologist with the primary care physician. The patient may be comfortable with the primary care physician in preference to the oncology, because he or she has known him all their lives. So we have to be cognizant of the role that the primary care physician could play and should play in the care of our survivors.
Have these modules that you created and also teach, have they trickled down to the primary care sector?
It's a challenge that primary care physicians sometimes don't want to bother with oncology patients. They say, okay, turn it over, and the oncologist is responsible. But there's a lot of things that we don't know about, like hypertension. When was the last time you treated hypertension or diabetes?
You know, I treated hypertension this morning. One of my patients on clinic had a high blood pressure, and I sent him to the emergency room. So that's how I treated their hypertension.
Well, my wife's a primary care provider. And, you know, she knows the latest and greatest in diabetes and cardiac management. I don't know that stuff. I'm focused on oncology. So we need each other.
Yeah, we do. But that actually brings up another hole in our game. I hate to say, you know, as physicians, we'd like to think that we're the greatest and everything, but we are so far short of that. We're very busy. Patients have these special needs. A patient comes in after treatment. We spend a lot less time with them than we do when they first come in, and we're trying to work up their case and trying to figure out how to shrink these tumors. We're really not that great at survivorship either.
Yeah, so that's why I advocate for nurse models, for example.
Yes, that was exactly where I was going.
Yeah, so nurse models of mid-level providers and nursing providers, they can do a lot of it too. They just have to be educated. And nurses have a special relationship, as you know, with cancer survivors. They're special, and they're special with all patients. So we should take advantage of the nursing aspect of that special relationship and teach them about survivorship. And they can do a lot of it too.
Absolutely. Last week we had a nurse practitioner who does the survivorship planning, you know, with the patients. And I have to tell you, for this past, I mean, I want to say two and a half years ago, I hired two nurse practitioners. I was very skeptical. I didn't want to give up control of the clinic with the acute reactions. I have to tell you, they run circles around me. Yeah. These two gals are amazing. And I believe, as you do, that this advanced caretaker, this, the nurse practitioner / PA model, I think that they would do a tremendous job that even a primary care physician can do, or even an oncologist can do, unless the oncologist is focused either on palliative care or focused on survivorship. So we are on the same page. But I wanted to ask you also, you mentioned risk stratifications. One of my interests, I guess you would say, even though I'm a generalist, is I love thyroid cancer. And I love thyroid cancer because patients usually do very well. But I also love the view of thyroid cancer. It's not a stagnant diagnosis. You're not a stage 3 high risk, you know, tall cell papillary thyroid cancer forever. If you're treated, you have your surgery, you have your iodine, and then you basically your thyroglobulin goes down to 0 and your scans are negative. You don't stay high risk for your whole life. You're dynamically stratified. And I think that was so nicely said in your paper, that also survivorship needs, survivorship risks should also be stratified into low, intermediate, and high. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that's a concept that's in about the past 10 to 15 years. People have proposed that, like, a bone marrow transplant patient who's a survivor has a lot of needs, as opposed to a breast cancer patient who maybe got radiation and mastectomy, and that's it. So the idea of the intensity of the resources you have to throw at these people changes. And when you risk stratify up front, you tend to be in a better position to apportion the resources that the various survivors need.
Very well said. So I wanted to sort of end on a really positive note, and you had mentioned it, and I believe this is going to be the path. So one of the reasons why our survivors are so needy, and I say that with love, I don't mean they're needy, dramatic, needy. They're needy because we've hurt them, we've caused side effects, and they have special needs. The de-escalation over the next 10, 15, 20 years, when you and I are going to be retired in Miami and we're going to be playing pinochle on Monday and shuffleboard on Tuesday, pickleball on Wednesday, golf on Thursday, and we're not going to be in the game anymore. What do you see the future for survivors?
Well, I see the future is bright. We're developing new treatments for peripheral neuropathy, for example. De-escalation as a concept is recognized, and there are a few dramatic examples that are already in place. I see the recognition of survivorship completely creeping in to the mainstream of cancer care over the next 30 years. Like, it's like genetic counseling 25 years ago. That was an offshoot. It wasn't integrated. Now it's integrated. Nobody would do a breast program without genetic counseling. So survivorship is going to get there. And it's a long time in coming, but it's necessary. And we're doing so well in certain cancers that it's almost inevitable that the long-term effects are going to be de-escalated, and there be treatments evolving for conditions like peripheral neuropathy. So I see the future is bright.
I do too. Angel, you can see Dr. Shapiro and I doing doubles in pickleball down in Florida, right?
I'm probably going to be the water boy at that point.
Angel, Dr. Shapiro, I always bring my producer Angel in to see if he has any questions or if he feels we did a good job in providing this information to our constituents.
I think that what we've built up over these last modules since we started only put an icing on the cake, so to speak.
Yeah,
having him on, having you tell me what we were getting ready to have on our show sheds light, and for me it's the culmination of everything.
Exactly.
So I thank you for just being a part of the show and also being a part of his career too, because he was really, really interested in that article. And for that, as a viewer and as a producer, I say thank you.
Yep. And Dr. Shapiro, really from the community side, we are all grateful for you and folk like you who really have done all the heavy lifting and the innovation and the pioneer work. And again, I mean, thank you for joining us, of course, but thank you for your career. I want to take a quick minute and ask you if you have any questions of us.
I admire you. Let me give it back to you. I admire you because the community physician has to do it all. And I know one thing and I know it well, but the community guys have to do it all and still be concerned with survivorship and still be concerned with all these issues. So I have great respect for the community guys like yourself, who, really are the salt of the earth, the really the front line of cancer care. And I thank you for your work in terms of building this podcast and initiating a survivor group. You were way ahead of your time, Tom, and I respect for you. Thank you for that.
Awesome. Well, just do me one favor. I need you actually do me two favors. Keep feeding us the bullets on the front line because we need them. And number two, please promise to come back on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Awesome. Croc Nation, this ends the end of our survivorship, defining survivorship module. Dr. Charles Shapiro, professor of medicine from Mount Sinai. Our gratitude shout outs, Angel Santana, Have Faith, Let It Begin. Rod Freeman, Small Biz Up, MichaelJohnBezea.com, and CharlotteLarson.net on the West Coast, who are our patrons. God bless you all. And as I end every podcast, I wish everyone, all of our survivors, all of our caregivers, a long, healthy, happy, and cancer-free life. Until next time.
Amen.